NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see you. And we have another face in the crowd sitting with us. He is a special guest. Yet again, all of our guests are special, but he is an extra special guest, Peter Greenberg, who we will get to here shortly. But first off, I want to talk about the fact that, John, you just walked in from Washington, D.C., where you received an award on behalf of AMC for your work and your really passion for the aviation maintenance competition that you've put together and that has been so successful over the years. So tell us what happened last night in Washington, D.C. with all the hobnobbers that you were hobnobbing with.
So it was quite an event. It's held in the National Museum. It's a beautiful building that was built in after the Civil War. It was really quite a venue. And all the old Washington players were there, and a whole bunch of new ones were there as well. And we did, for the competition, we did receive some recognition for what we've brought to the industry. As both Todd and Greg, you know, we've been bringing in students to demonstrate their skills in maintenance arena for 12 years. And over that period of time, the industry has hired over 1,000 of the students that have come to our competition, including around 150 women.
That's great.
So the industry recognized the contribution that we've made to bringing the talent in, to try to motivate the young people to pursue this line of career. And for many, many people, it's a great career. And the sky literally is the limit, because if you look at what I've done, I started turning wrenches and ended up where I am, and it's all because of aviation.
Yeah, so I know. It started with bicycle pedals and the Wright brothers. So yeah, we're very blessed that we have you and all of your experience and the passion that you bring to that aspect of aviation and aviation safety. So, and I know that Todd and I are both proud of the fact that we are associated with AMC and you, and that, I sit on the board of PAMA with you as well, all in the interest of trying not only to enhance the maintenance side of aviation, but enhance the safety side of aviation as well. When it comes to maintenance. And we're going to be actually talking about that with Peter here shortly. But before we get there, let me introduce our good friend, Peter Greenberg. And he has got a recognizable face, almost like you, John. He's almost as recognizable as you, especially in the aviation industry. But many people will have recognized Peter because he is the travel editor for CBS. And he does a lot of things with CBS and CBS News with regard to aviation. He's not just the travel guru, and he has a show called The Travel Detective. So based on the fact that he is the travel detective, he has automatically now been brought into the fold with the flight safety detectives because he too is a detective. So welcome into the group, Peter. But you've had a lot of accomplishments over your vast career, number of books. You've put together some great documentary shows, and I've been fortunate enough to work with you on a lot of those shows. But you've talked to at least me and John at length about a variety of different aviation-related topics, aviation safety, and things like that. And one of the things that we get asked all the time, especially right now, and I'm sure you do too, is how safe is it to travel by air? And I know that you're traveling all the time, and you've been gracious enough to give us your time because you just flew into Denver from some place beyond to do a presentation tomorrow. But, you know, welcome to the show, and let us know what your perspective is about traveling right now, given the fact that we've had all of these recent events.
Well, the big picture, of course, is we've just celebrated the 30 safest years in commercial aviation since aviation began. But you wouldn't know that based on by all the incidents that have been reported recently. And that's the key. We live in a world of citizen journalism. There are cameras everywhere. They're operating and they're recording. And from an investigation point of view, that's a good thing. But from a public perception point of view, it scares a lot of people. If you take a look just in the last, month and a half, whether it was Washington Reagan or the Philadelphia MedJet, even the Learjet landing gear separation in Scottsdale, the Toronto crash of the RJ. The interesting thing there is how many cameras were there that even at night that caught it from various distances and perspectives. So it's being reported more often, but the actual number of incidents is where it's always been, or even sometimes even a little less.
And when you look at all of these events, and of course we got the dramatic videos or pictures and things like that, given the fact that you are on CBS and you have a travel show on PBS as well, and you know you're a well-known voice in the industry, what is it? I mean, as far as trying to present that information in an objective way, so we don't scare the hell out of the flying public, but we report what's going on. I mean, do you have that? Do you have that as an issue when you're trying to, you know, maintain that balance? You know, given the fact that you are in a position of being an expert.
Well, I have that position internally within all the networks that I've worked at, whether it was ABC for 7 years or NBC for 14 years when you and I first started working together. Mm-hmm. And now for the last 16 years at CBS, it's to educate the people I report to within the news divisions about what's important, what isn't, and what they should not get hysterical about. Because visual images are very powerful. And we all know that. But the problem is to let them know what isn't happening yet, what hasn't been decided yet. You know, we live in a world in which everybody wants the end of the show to happen in 43 minutes on television.
Yeah.
But that's not how the NTSB works. That's not how you guys work. And conversely, or actually in addition, that's not how I work. And so I'm constantly putting on the brakes to say, look, I can tell you what they're looking at. I can't tell you what they've decided yet or what they've concluded yet. Because the questions that I get asked are usually asked from people, and I'm not saying this in an elitist way. I understand why they're asking it that way. They don't know the difference between an aileron and a Greyhound bus.
Yeah.
So, before we could ever go on the air and report something, I have to educate my superiors first so they know in proper perspective and context what's important to report and what's important not to judge.
Now, let me ask you something about that issue, not just from the management perspective, but from the public perspective. We've all been around aviation for a long time, and we remember a time only a couple decades ago where we had the luxury of time. The news cycle was such where something could happen. We might have hours or even a day or two before we could say something thoughtful about it and time to gather information and data. Now, the moment we hear about the crash, it's already out there on the internet and there are already people talking about it, including conspiracy theorists. How has that changed your approach to reporting on these events when they happen?
Well, the initial reaction, of course, is to move faster to beat them out of the gate, but that doesn't accomplish anything. As you guys know better than anyone, No crash ever happens or no accident ever happens for any one reason. It's a combination of reasons that in concert creates a situation that you can't recover from, and that's what the investigators look for. So you can take the initial first reaction from what you see visually, assuming there are witnesses or there's video, and go, ah, I know what happened. But you don't. And I mean, we could have a we could spend this entire show talking about our intuition, and 90% of the chance of the time we'd be right, but that wouldn't be responsible. And so I can't avoid what they're going to talk about on the internet. I can't avoid what they're going to talk about at the water cooler. What I can avoid is what I'm going to talk about without the proper background that allows me to then talk about it with some degree of clarity and some degree of protocol and portfolio. If you don't do that, then you might as well be on the internet. And so to answer your question, Todd, I can't stop that, right? I can't stop what anybody's talking about me right now. And believe me, talk about me.
Yeah, we all get that, Peter. Yeah, trust me.
So, I mean, you got to go by the book. And sometimes you're writing the book as you go along. But the point is, remember, I'm not an NTSB investigator, although I've actually worked on aircraft accidents since 1975. So it's 50 years for me now, starting when I was at Newsweek. And what did I have to do? I had to develop the relationships with the investigators, with the manufacturers, with the federal agencies, so that I could develop some trust, and so that they understood that I wasn't just. I'll give you an example. This will put everything in perspective. Years ago, there was a mid-air collision over Corona, California, between two private aircraft, and I was set down by the network to report on it. I'm also a fireman in New York. I carry a badge. So when I got there, I was able to go in with the fire department, and there was one guy who had come down from L.A., who actually was NTSB. He got there right away. And so I was in there with him, and I wasn't jumping to any conclusions. We then came out, and he was going to give a press briefing. And a reporter from another network, you cannot make this up, asked the following question. Sir, were both planes flying at the same altitude when they hit? Okay, this is what I'm working with every day. So the whole idea is to slow things down, not speed them up.
So if you could put it in a soundbite or two, what piece of advice, soundbite or two, because there's a short attention span on the internet, to those folks out there who are producing content, dealing with aviation safety, some of whom are aviation experts, some of whom are just enthusiasts, what piece of advice would you give them to be more responsible and useful when it comes to what they're doing?
It's okay to participate in the discussion, but do not jump to conclusions because you're being irresponsible.
Yeah, that seems to be the message that we, not only in this show, but you know, every time there is an event, we try to couch every one of our discussions with, look, here's what the investigators are going to do. Here's what the pathways are that they'll be looking at based on what we know right now. Yes, right. Things are going to change as more information comes in, as we talked about off the air. But we do have the internet trolls out there and the junior investigators who want to show how smart they are and come up with a probable cause within an hour after the event. Pilot experience.
Well, I'll give you the best example. In my experience, was May 25th, 1979, American Flight 191 in Chicago. Everybody jumped to an immediate conclusion that the plane was defective, that it was a badly built and designed plane. And, you know, I ended up doing 2 one-hour specials on the investigation and how they found out what really happened in the sequence in which it happened, which went in an entirely different direction.
Yes.
But that show of mine took 2 years to do, not 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But guess what happened? The DC-10 got grounded and it went out of production. And there's still DC-10s flying today very safely. But the point is that immediate jump to conclusion can be devastating.
And John knows that because he's had to deal with the politics of it. And he's been on both sides of the fence, if you will. And, you know, he's familiar, John, with 191 and some of the fallout from that as well.
Well, let's fast forward to one of the most recent events and jump into conclusions. One that we've all talked about on air and off air. That's the mid-air collision over D.C., where very prominent people in government, very soon after this, pointed to DEI as a reason behind why this happened, in the absence of any evidence. Now, this might have incensed many people, including all the folks in this podcast today, but it's out there. It's inescapable. It's being talked about by the folks troll and non-troll on the internet. So when you have this out there, what do we in the business or in media do to at least put some brakes on that and put some perspective on that?
Well, if I can jump in being a member of the media, all I can tell you is the internet is inevitable now. You can't fight it. It's a necessary, or I should say an unnecessary, but prevalent evil. And what you can only do about it is, remember, in any accident investigation, you're always ruling everything out before you rule any one thing in. So the minute you can rule something out, you go in the air with it before you ever rule anything in. Just rule the stuff that you can rule out now. And the minute I heard the president, before even the NTSB had given a press conference, the president was calling, saying, oh, I heard it was DEI.
Yeah,
that started the ball rolling in a completely wrong and irresponsible direction. And I went on the air immediately and said, I will stake my career on the fact this has nothing to do with DEI. Now, I can't tell you what really happened yet, but I can tell you it wasn't that. Now, people either believe me or they don't, but the people who know me would know that I wouldn't say that unless I knew it was true. So on that one, that's all you can do. I can't go on the air and say it wasn't DEI, it was this, because we haven't even heard the final report yet. Now, as they rule everything out, you can begin, at least intuitively, to figure out what could have happened and what those linkages were to create a tragic situation. But even now, if you were to say to me, what happened at Reagan, I can only tell you what they're still looking at. I am not going to tell you what they concluded because they haven't told me yet.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, Peter, because regardless of, you know, whatever gender is in that cockpit, if you have errors in the operation and a lack of operational discipline, it doesn't matter if you have two males, two females, or a combination thereof. You know, if you have one pilot reporting, you know, on their altimeter at a particular checkpoint, 400 feet, and the other pilot saying 300 feet, it doesn't matter, male or female. You got to resolve that issue. You
Correct.
Have to follow a set of standards. You have to follow a set of procedures. You have to take whatever corrective action. That has nothing to do with DEI. That has a lot to do, if not all things to do, with operational discipline. And you know, that's where these facts, conditions, and circumstances then put the storyline together. It's not about gender in this particular instance.
And by the way, but the minute that goes public, it sends a dog whistle to every racist and misogynist out there that that's actually a probable cause of the crash, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I've flown, I can't tell you, well, I can tell you, I've flown about 30 million miles that I can actually calculate myself.
Yeah.
And at least one quarter of them have been women pilots or minority pilots who I felt more comfortable with than anybody else because yeah. I knew what they went through to get there. And you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way.
So, and everybody is required to meet a qualification standard, period. There is no fudging, especially in aviation. Yet, can you have people slip into a system that may not be ace of the base? Absolutely. But you find that in every profession, whether it's government, non-government, it doesn't matter. Every profession has those stellar performers and those marginal performers, but they get the job done in some way, shape, or form. And again, we go back a long time when women were first getting in the cockpit. One of the big issues with women is they aren't strong enough to manhandle an airplane if you lose the hydraulic system on a 727 or something like that. You know, they don't have enough, you know, strength to be able to pull the yoke back if they're pulling against aerodynamic forces. There are a lot of guys out there that can't do it.
Right.
You know, so it has nothing to do with gender, color, anything else. It is about physical ability and the fact that, okay, it's an airplane and you better be prepared to take whatever corrective action is necessary.
And let me add also.
And all I can tell you is I've had the opportunity at least six times a year to do my, by the way, I am not a licensed pilot. I don't play one on television, but I've had the opportunity to train six times a year in the simulators.
Yeah.
State-of-the-art simulators, I come out of there with such newfound respect for the training that goes through and all the things they can throw up on the screen in real world, real life, real time simulations that, you know what? I have no problem getting on any airplane today because I know about the training.
So, Sherry, when I'm calling, I know that you offer a variety of different products because I have CFI insurance through you. What other insurance products do you have for individuals?
We have non-owned policies for those people that are going to flight school and they need to have supplemental coverage or the school's requiring it. In addition to that, non-owned CFI coverage where you're flying or instructing in a borrowed or rented aircraft. We also have, of course, owned aircraft policies, and in addition to you just using it for personal use, some incidental instructing as well. We would have to talk with you about the type of aircraft. We do insure some flying clubs, equity-owned flying clubs, construction policies. When you get that kit plane and you're building it in your garage, we have coverage for that as well. We also have coverage for experimental aircraft. And then finally, our policy does offer coverage in Mexico, the actual policy territory, but we also partner with another company, McAfee and Edwards, where they provide additional coverage for Mexico.
Why? Why do I need that?
Well, sometimes, depending on where you're flying into Mexico, they, for example, may want you to have a policy in Spanish.
Huh?
If you have an incident in Mexico, you want to make sure that you're covered
sure.
and that there's not going to be some kind of conflict. It's, you know, you're in a foreign country, so it's good to do your research when you're flying down that way.
Now, I know a lot of people fly out to the Bahamas, or they may go out even to Costa Rica or mm-hmm. Panama on their airplane. Do the policies cover that, or do I need a supplemental policy?
No, it does. It does cover the Bahamas. There are certain areas. Puerto Rico is covered. I believe Bermuda is not covered. There's certain areas that we would have to talk. Central America, Mexico is covered, but Central America would not be covered.
So the point being that if you are a client of Avemco, mm-hmm. I should pick up the phone and make sure that my airplane's
right.
covered if I fly to someplace
right.
outside the United
well,
States.
Well, and the great thing about our website also is the policy is actually printed on our website. It's 10 pages. If you go visit our website, if you're insured with us or not, you could go and see what the coverage offers. Mm-hmm. Very last page of the policy booklet is a territory map.
Oh, great.
Super easy to understand. It tells you what longitude, latitude lines, and shows actually a picture. So you could actually go there, and of course you can always call us.
And let me add a little context to this. You know, we're talking about these issues in the United States, but aviation is an inherently global enterprise. And the time that I first recognized this was back in 1972. I was still a kid. I was in middle school. And Nixon went to China. And there was a deal to sell 707s to China. And what little I knew about the world, it's like, oh, my gosh, China is almost a sworn enemy. Yet we're entrusting them with buying some of the highest technology products that we have. And that example has been happening for 50 plus years. No matter what the political situation is, there are clients all over the world. And we as aviation professionals, we don't care who we give advice to. If North Korea is out there listening to this and learning from us, great. And because the sky doesn't care about all the other stuff, doesn't care about gender, race, how much money's in your pocket. All they care about is the sky. So as long as we keep that attitude, I think that the temporary excursions, politically and otherwise, that happen in this country and elsewhere will not be a problem.
One of the things that we talk about, Peter, at least I've talked about a number of times when we talk about aviation and aviation safety, When you look at here, just in the United States, we're running about 47,000 plus operations in a 24-hour period of all aircraft. And when you look at a map of the United States during any hour period and you see all that traffic and you think about the fact that, I mean, we can't control airplane or automobiles that well. I mean, we're still killing 40,000 people plus a year in automobile accidents on the nation's highways. And that number really hasn't altered a whole lot over the last 50 plus years, even though we have better technology, better training and things like that. But yet aviation over that same period of time has vastly improved. And like you brought up at the beginning of the show, yeah, we should be celebrating the fact that we've had the safest period in this 30-year period.
Except let me give you the but.
Yeah.
And this is what I write about all the time. It's true. We need to celebrate and acknowledge that amazing safety record. But the challenge is not acknowledging that safety record or improving it. The challenge is maintaining it. And the problem is right now, I go back to a longstanding problem, or I should say problems, I've had with the FAA as a regulator, as they define their role. Going back to 1935, I go back to their relationships with manufacturers and operators. I go back with their staffing issues that go way beyond air traffic control towers. It goes back to inspection and oversight and long-term planning. And, of course, one of my favorite topics, which I'm sure we'll talk to you later, is MROs. The real problem is that until we fix the definition of terms about what's the real mandate of the FAA, We're not going to be able to maintain that record because they still think of the airlines and the manufacturers as their clients. They still think about economic impact or cost benefit when there's an available solution to a known problem, that should not even be part of the discussion at all. And we could spend the next three shows just going through the NTSB most wanted list of recommendations they've made to the FAA that they either slow walked or they ignored or both. And to me, that's the height of your responsibility.
Yeah.
And Peter, you just struck a nerve with me because we've been fighting the battle over kid seats for 50 years.
John, let me tell you, we actually went on the air with this. They still allow parents to hold kids in their laps, and the evidence is not just overwhelming; it's concrete that no parent in a survivable hard landing or aborted takeoff can really maintain the control over their kid who's not properly restrained. And here's what happened: the NTSB has done so much research over the last 30 years, including going into the laboratory with simulated crash test dummies at high Gs, but survivable Gs. And they determined that what needed to be done based on the weight of the child, not the age of the child, whether it should be a rear-facing restraint seat or a forward-facing restraint seat. And they made an urgent recommendation to the FAA. Well, under federal protocols, the FAA has 90 days to respond. So what did they do? On the 89th day, they said, we'd like to study it. And that constituted an acceptable response.
Yeah.
But to their credit, what did the FAA do? They went to their own testing labs, got their own crash test dummies, and did the exact same test. We got that video. We got that video from the FAA. And what did it show? Every kid died. Right? So now they were confronted with unbelievable, incontrovertible evidence. Right? So you had a problem and you had a solution. So what did the FAA do? They slow walked it. And I kept on asking them what they were going to do. And you know what they finally did? And I'm going to quote this because I've never forgotten it. They made a statement that, yes, the evidence was overwhelming. They couldn't hide it. Yes, these crash test dummies in real life would have died. Okay. However, if we ask the airlines to provide these seats for kids, then the airlines would only raise ticket prices, and then people who would otherwise fly would die in automobile accidents. And I went on NBC and said, when I want the FAA to talk about highway safety, I'm going to ask them. Right now, this is not about highway safety, and they're irresponsible. There's a problem, there's a solution, and they've consciously chosen not to implement that solution because they deferred to the economic cost to the airlines. That, to me, is almost criminal.
Peter, I'm glad you guys brought this up. I invented a solution 10 years ago called Lab Kits. And I went in, I spent a lot of money doing my own crash test at a facility that certifies basically child safety seats. The seat that I invented outperformed car seats that are mounted in airplane seats because, one, they're not designed to be mounted in an airplane seat. Two, they're usually installed incorrectly. And so I came up with a solution. I went to the NTSB with it. They basically said, pound sand, don't talk to us about it. You know the problem, because I wrote several recommendations about
it. It's the FAA.
Yeah. And so I went to the FAA. And they said, yeah, you can, you know, people can use your seat, but they can't use it on the ground for takeoff, taxi, landing.
What?
And it made no sense. It's this loophole, or it's this issue in that was in 1958. And we can have a whole discussion about this. The fact is, I came up with a solution to help.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very simple solution. It's a seat that doesn't cost a lot of money, but it provides better protection for that child than what you were talking about, Peter, and that is the natural act of arms flailing and child or a right. child flying as a projectile during turbulence, during crashes of any kind that are survivable. Right. And we saw that with the United 232 and a variety of others.
I still speak to the flight attendants who survived that crash, and they recall in horror what happened to those lap kids because those seats were not there.
Yeah,
and some of them actually take it personally because they gave instructions to the families on what to do with the infant per the manual, put it under the seat in front of you type thing. And when the kid perished, they feel like they had that. They totally are instructed the family to do that, and the kid perished.
Yeah,
and this is a situation where, unfortunately, it might take a dramatic, fatal event to get the regulatory wheels turning. But I'm hoping that maybe there's some other way of getting attention to it. For example, all of us are to an extent in the nightmare scenario business. And there was a nightmare scenario beginning of last year, which if there had been a lap child involved, it would have spun this in a whole different direction. When that door blew out on the 737 over Oregon, right. There was no one sitting adjacent to that seat. Could you imagine what the result would have been if the only person who perished was a lap child sitting in the middle seat or the window seat who gets ejected out of the window?
Okay, but Todd, but you're absolutely right about that, with one small exception. And that is, we'd be right back to where we started from again, with the FAA not taking action, because that's what they've always done. You need somebody who's the administrator of the FAA, who doesn't come from the industry, who doesn't come from his last previous job being an airline or a lobbyist for an airline, to be able to say, what's our role? Who are our clients? The clients are the citizens of the United States of America, not the manufacturers and not the operators. And they've never come to grips with that.
But Peter, you know that the biggest issue now is what we've had 5 or 6 administrators in a 7-year period. It's a revolving door over there. Nobody gets established. Nobody sets a policy or a precedent before the next administration boots them, or they walk out the door for a variety of other reasons. There is no consistency. And in this case right now, we've lost the 4 top administration people at the FAA. We got a bunch of actings. Well, actings will not put their head above sand and, you know, take a stand for anything because they don't want to get shot at. They believe they're not in a power position to be able to make change. Absolutely they are. And all of the former administrators that walked out the door could have made change, but they chose not to, so they could go into the private sector and go find a job. And it's like, do something positive for the industry. You're not coming back.
Right.
So do something positive.
But
and
here's the other problem.
Failed to do that.
But here's the other problem. All the other guys who weren't acting were saddled with budgetary problems. They never got enough money to hire the right people, to hire enough people, and to be strong enough to say, we're going back to a real definition of our role here.
Yeah.
Not to promote the business of aviation. It's to enact and enforce safety. Period. We're done. And they've never done it, right?
But you also know that we've been fighting this battle, at least, you know, from the NTSB perspective, is that safety doesn't have a dollar value when it comes to what the NTSB recommends to improve or enhance aviation safety. However, the FAA has that dual mandate, promote aviation.
Right.
And, you know, promote aviation safety. Well,
but if you go back to the last 10 things the NTSB has recommended to the FAA as an urgent safety recommendation, none of them were billion-dollar babies.
Yeah.
They were, hey, here's a simple fix. Look, if I'm holding this pen up, right, and I'm holding it up with two fingers, and all of a sudden the pen drops and everybody dies, okay, they investigate. Fair enough. We don't know what happened. We're going to find out. Now they investigate. They find out what you really need is three fingers. Wow, yeah. That's a lot. And guess what? The third finger's available, and we can put it in. At that point, if we make the conscious decision that we know there's an available solution and we make the decision not to implement it, I'm not a lawyer, but I could prosecute a very clear case of criminal negligence.
Yeah. And again, we talked off the air, and John and I and Todd have talked about this, and my simple solution to the midair issue, I mean, they want to make this such a complex issue. We haven't had a mid-air collision between any kind of helicopter and a fixed-wing aircraft flying over the Potomac in the same regard, for the time that that's been happening. And they've been flying helicopters and fixed-wings up and down the Potomac for better than 70 years. The fact of the matter is that there's a very simple solution, and we talked about it. And again, it's you don't allow circle-to-land approaches at night to runway 33. Period. Done deal. You've solved the issue. You put everybody on the main north-south runway. You keep them off 33 where it puts an aircraft over the low-altitude flyways. It's a very simple fix. You can implement. They could have implemented it an hour after that accident, but they want to restructure the airspace. Now you put those low-level helicopters and other aircraft over Anacostia, over Alexandria, over the Pentagon, over all of those areas. What happens if you lose an engine in a helicopter and you're at 300 feet over Alexandria, Virginia? You're going into somebody's backyard.
Right.
I mean, you've now increased, you know, the safety risk rather than mitigate the safety risk.
And not only that, Greg, you and I both know that after about 8 o'clock at night, the traffic coming into runway 33 is negligible.
Yes. It's even negligible. It's very minimal going into the main north-south runways.
Right.
Why? Because they're bumping up against the curfew. So you don't have a lot of flights, you know, landing and taking off. So, I mean, it's a very simple fix. They could have implemented it. We could have moved down. But now they want to screw around and make it a more complex issue than it actually is.
Well, you know, I go back to it.
And part of the problem for all of this, nobody says it, I was waiting to see if anybody here would say it, is that we just allow too many flights.
Well, you know what, John? This goes into runway capacity. I mean, I've said this for so long. You know, I failed math in high school, but I could do basic arithmetic. There's not a runway in the world that can handle more than 23 takeoffs in an hour because of separation. We get that. And there are only a certain number of gates and jetways. So when we see the increase in the number of runway incursions, which has been bigger last year and this year than the last decade, and when we see the number of slow motion tarmac collisions, it's because the airports themselves haven't spoken up about their own capacity issues. And you can't allow airlines to schedule 40 departures at 8 o'clock in the morning when you know the runway can only handle 23. It's not rocket science here. You know, I go back, I'm going to share a story with you guys because it haunts me to this day. When I was a correspondent for Newsweek, I got a phone call one day. I remember their names very well. Don McBain, who was a veteran airline captain for United, and Sidney Hill, who was then flying for Western. I was based in Los Angeles. And they said, can we take you to lunch? Sure. I go to lunch with them and they say, look, we're having a problem and nobody's listening to us at our own airlines. We think the approach to San Diego's Lindbergh Field is too dangerous. There's too much private aviation out there. There's too many planes in the sky. None of them are controlled. I mean, it's like you know, cowboys and Indians. And I said, really? They said, listen, we got a plane out of Torrance. Would you come fly the approach with us? We want to show you. So the next day I went down to Torrance. We got in their plane. We flew the approach to Lindbergh. Boy, were they right. Oh, my God, just looking out the window, I can't believe you guys do this. And they told me exactly what was needed. I send a note to Newsweek in New York saying, we've got to do a story right now because it's clear to me that Lindbergh Field is an accident waiting to happen. I sent that note in 1977. I got a note back from them. I will quote it verbatim. Great suggestion on Lindbergh Field, but the editors here would rather wait until there's a crash. Huh. On September 25th, 1978, I had already left Newsweek. I was in New York, and I got a phone call at about 11:30 in the morning, 8:30 in the morning, L.A. time, that exact collision had happened. That was PSA Flight 182. And yeah. As a result of that, thankfully, the tombstone mentality kicks in, things that Todd just brought up, and that's when they started putting together TCAs. But here's the problem. Do we have to wait until there's a crash before we do something? And that's our problem. That's always been in existence, John. And so when you bring up too many planes in the sky, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I sat through a discussion at a major airport as a fly in the wall. I didn't have any input, but I listened to them debate amongst themselves the problem of allowing more airplanes land to collect the additional landing fees or to raise the fees for the parking garage. And many of the people in the room did not want to raise the fees for the parking garage because they were already quite high. And they were advocates for increasing the flights in an airport that they agreed was already saturated.
Yeah, but you know what, John? I'll give you another example. It's not about aviation, but it still proves the point. We all hear the words over-tourism. So Venice is getting completely inundated with so many tourists that the Bridge of Sighs is now the Bridge of Thighs, okay? So what did they do? They instituted a 5 euro fee last year to anybody who couldn't prove they had a hotel reservation. Guess what? Millions of people paid the fee and came anyway. So what did they do for this year? They raised it to 10 euros. They're still going to come. That's not the issue. People are going to want to fly. You're going to have to actually just do a restriction. Otherwise, you're not going to solve the problem.
Yeah, well, you know, and a lot of people said, well, they should have closed National Airport when they built Dulles and everything else. That's one, ridiculous. I mean, again, sure. The airport is very convenient, especially for the folks that work, you know, in and around the White
House. That's like closing Burbank because of LAX. No, keep it open.
Yeah, but there is a controlled way of handling issues. And for a very long time, yeah, we've controlled those issues. Now everybody's, oh, my God, there's always these near misses and everything else. No, well, when the airplanes are 2,000 feet apart, is that really a near miss? But it triggers a TCAS and everybody makes a big story about, you know, all of that. Hell, you get a TCAS every time you fly a parallel approach going into a lot of these airports because the runways are very close and you'll trigger a TCAS. That's just the system that works. And while, yes, it does enhance aviation safety, it heightens the awareness of the flight crew that, yeah, there's an airplane coming in on the parallel. Okay, great. But we can't knee-jerk react like we did with Continental Express and go to a 1,500-hour rule for co-pilots because I know 500-hour pilots that are better than 5,000-hour pilots. That 1,500-hour rule seemed to make people feel good, but it really did it really enhance aviation safety?
An interesting story about Colgan Air, because I covered that story. You want to look at what really caused that problem? It was flight training of the pilot and inexperience of the co-pilot in a situation like that, and it had nothing to do with the number of hours, because that pilot had significant hours, but he'd failed two tests. And when there was ice on the wings and the stick shaker started shaking, what did he do? He pulled up.
Yeah.
End of story.
The wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of these things, and that's why, you know, they're putting these advisory committees together. At least that's what the Secretary of Transportation is talking about. Hell, they need the four of us to sit and bring some reality to the discussion. A lot of these advisory committees are made up of hierarchy management, C-suite people that really aren't plugged in at the grassroots ground level. And, you know, you've got to bring some reality to what's going on out there in the industry, not from a C-suite perspective. And it's very frustrating because we talk about it on our show. I know you talk about it on your shows. And the fact is, this is what's going on, not from a look down procedure, but our perspective, but from this is where we are. We are interactive in this system. We know what's going on. We have viable solutions, or at least the solutions we can throw out on the table and have a substantive discussion. Which
brings one more thing that goes back to something I know I've talked about with John before. I'm going to give you two words. When I give you the two words, you're all going to start laughing. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here it comes. Next gen. There you go. I knew you'd start laughing. I mean, who are they kidding? They've been talking about next gen for two gens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. What next gen are they referring to? The next gen in 2050 or 21? Who knows?
So on that subject of next gen, here's something we talked about on a previous show not too long ago. The next gen of advanced air mobility. You talk about C-suite mentality. How about VC suite, venture capital mentality? There's big money out there to try and get off the ground, basically multi-rotor vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that will be flying all over the place in urban areas and elsewhere, as well as cargo delivering drones, which Amazon and others are working on. A world where instead of having X number of planes, aircraft rather, in an airspace, you might have 10X. And if there are issues with dealing with what we've had before with runway incursions and overcrowding, how likely is it to be out of control when you have a world where you have thousands of delivery drones, hundreds of advanced air mobility, low capacity aircraft out there?
You know what? I can answer it one way. It's great to embrace technology as long as it doesn't take precedence over common sense. And the problem right now is, you got to fix the system while you're also developing the technology. And if you don't fix the system, the technology is just going to add to your problems.
But you got to fix the system with a level of knowledge. You can't go in there and expect that AI is going to be a magic bullet and that, it's going to fix everything. We know that, when we tried to establish free flight, point to point, direct flights, point to point, it didn't work. Why? Because it couldn't handle the capacity when you got 100 airplanes arriving at the same piece of concrete at the same time. This airspace system, the national airspace system, has evolved over, probably 7-8 decades. This isn't just haphazard. It's evolved. And it has to be very fluid and dynamic. Why? Because if an airport goes down like Boston or JFK or LaGuardia or Newark, you have a ripple effect all the way across the country. AI can't come up with a solution for all of that. We have ground stops. Look what happened just recently, last night, when that SpaceX aircraft or rocket blew up. They shut down the entire airspace across the country. They had ground stops for better than 45 minutes. Why? Because they were afraid of falling pieces out of the off of that blown up rocket hitting aircraft. Okay, so now what does that do with the rest of the country? Puts everybody into a hold. And again, you can't come up with point to point and use AI and computer technology without really understanding the airspace. And as Todd just brought up, who's going to control the airspace below 1,000 feet when all these drones, when all these little, e-Ubers, if you will, are starting to fly around?
Hey, look, we don't have enough controllers to control the airspace above 1,000 feet.
Yes. So,
there you go.
Yeah. So, well, let's, I think that we could continue this discussion infinitum because there are just so many things. And again, these knee-jerk reactions are not going to satisfy the issue. And in fact, I think they're going to increase the risk because they have to be well thought out. You really have to. I mean, that's why the FAA created the TMU, that traffic management unit, and really put a CEO in charge of air traffic was to try and get this all together. It's very interesting. And John and I had this conversation. It's very interesting that the CEO of the air traffic group has been very silent throughout all of these issues regarding air traffic. And it's like, well, what's going on there? Is there really a CEO in that position who is supposed to be managing the air traffic? That whole position was created because the air traffic piece is so big, we need to have somebody separate to control it. Man, I haven't seen anybody come out there and say, I am the CEO and this is what we're looking at.
Yep.
So it's going to be an interesting, period of time coming, especially in the next 12 months. to see what they're going to do, because they keep talking about restructuring the air system and or the airspace and, you know, fast tracking these controllers. You can only fast track them so much. And Peter, you remember this because I know John and Todd do. When Reagan fired 5,000 controllers because they went on strike, you know, trying to ramp up, pulling military guys in and everybody else and tried to ramp it up. You can only do it so fast. And, oh, by the way, the good thing is, in my perspective, is they have a very high washout rate. They got better than 30% washing out. And people go, oh, my God, you can't have that. You'll never hire anybody. You don't want those people that can't meet the mark controlling airplanes. So, yeah, you got a very good trap line. You're getting the best of the best. And, you know, you have to look at it that perspective versus, well, let's lower the standard. You don't need a college degree anymore. You only need a high school diploma. What the hell does a 19-year-old know going into an air traffic control job? They haven't even matured yet. I mean, that's really what college does, is provide a level of maturity to you.
Speak for yourself.
And commitment.
I was going to say it just the opposite way. It doesn't always work.
Well, that's true, because, I mean, look at us. So,
you could sum up almost this entire discussion in just a few words. Trust. We all put our trust in the FAA, and the FAA has let us all down.
But again, you need to have steady leadership. You need to have committed leadership there. And to have the administrator walking out the door after a year, year and a half, 2 years, and it's a revolving door, you'll never get any consistency. It's like trying to raise a kid. You got to give them structure. Well, every time a new administrator comes in, they got a different focus. They got a different structure. And just about the time that everybody's adapting to it, boom, they're gone and someone else comes in, you know, with, you know, their particular agenda. You cannot accomplish what you need to accomplish if you don't have steady rock leadership.
Look, you've got dedicated staff at the FAA. I know this. You have people there who are very talented, who are very smart. But as Greg just said, if you don't have the leadership and it's not sustained and you don't change the definition of their role, nothing will ever get done.
Yeah.
You know, and we got partially where we are today because we had somebody very competent running a good piece of it, Tony Broderick, when he was there. And I fought with Tony Broderick tooth and nail hundreds of times. I saw his son last night. I didn't always agree with him, but he was there running the ship.
Yep.
And we have not had that since they fired Tony Broderick.
Yeah. And it's really sad. And we really got to get back to that. I mean, you can't make all these improvements and expect them to work or be sustainable if you don't have anybody that's going to be there to enhance it, tweak it, and make sure that it's working with the same mindset. It's just not, it is not going to work. So, well, I think, gentlemen, from that perspective, we covered a lot of territory with Peter. It's been great getting a different perspective. And I know that this is going to be a very good show. It's going to be an interesting show for our listeners and viewers. So I want to say thank you, Peter, for joining us. You are now part of the flight safety detective team because you are the travel detective. And folks can watch your shows not only on CBS and your commentary, but also on PBS as well. And, of course, you got a number of books out there. I've been very fortunate to have worked with you on a number of your documentaries. One was about the accident involving the SST. And the Continental DC-10 that shed a tire and things like that. There's a lot on the internet, especially YouTube, starring Peter. And I would encourage you all to watch his shows because he does an outstanding job bringing all the facts, conditions, and circumstances together. And he also brings additional information that you don't normally see either in an accident report or, you know, from a just basically from a public perspective. So
I know. Greg, wait a minute. Peter, what do you think about the folding wings on that Challenger?
Well, that was an amazing story. And the video tends to support, you know, once the landing gear crushed. You talk about Toronto, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking about Toronto, but there was an expert on a competing channel from you who said on air that the wings on airplanes are designed to fold up and break off.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that I rest my case. There you go. Listen, that, I call that a miracle crash, the way that he ended up inverted evenly, that there was no breakup of the aircraft and no post-crash fire of significance. That truly was a miracle. And again, if you ask me what happened, I can tell you what they're looking at, but I can't tell you yet what really happened.
Well, I'll tell you what. Because we've had such a great conversation and we have so much more to talk about with you, we are going to bring you back for another couple of shows. And we're going to hit these topics. I know we wanted to talk about maintenance, repair, and overhaul operations, MRO operations, which that in and of itself will be a complete show. So we will bring you back for a separate show for that. And then we will dissect some of the other, not only just the accidents in a global perspective, but what's really going on with passenger safety and the attitudes and all of the fights that these people are getting into on airplanes. And the fact that, you know, I mean, you now, instead of having just passengers fighting with flight attendants and that kind of thing, now you got passengers fighting with passengers. I just read a story last night about a person who stacked all their luggage and carry-on stuff in the seat next to him, thinking that that was going to prevent somebody from sitting in that seat.
Wait a minute. I do that all the time. No.
I had one earlier this week, two passengers fighting over overhead space.
Yeah.
Guy comes on late with an overhead bag, takes a bag out of the overhead to put his in, and then calls the flight attendant to give the other person's bag. And fortunately, the flight attendant saw what was going on. And
we've lost our ethics. We've lost our decorum. We've lost our respect.
Well, contributing to that, I have to tell you, is interior aircraft design, with the airplanes now physically impossible for them to carry all the carry-on bags, even one bag per passenger, because they've added so many extra seats to existing aircraft.
Correct.
Number one. And number two, which we'll talk about the next time, is my solution to at least half the onboard battles that are happening today. I guarantee you, when you hear it, you'll accept it and you'll promote it.
Damn. So, okay, now we got two new shows. So I'm going to follow your schedule. We're going to have you back on so that we can discuss all of this, because, again, this is all in the interest of aviation safety. So, Peter, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. You know, your friendship means a lot. And, of course, now you are one of us, the detectives, and we look forward to having you as a regular contributor in this discussion. So thank
you. Well, Greg, thank you. And thank you, Todd. And of course, great to see you again, John, and looking forward to continuing the conversation.
So with that, Todd, I will leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, this time, the second to the last word goes out to all those folks who are coming up behind us, those folks in the younger generation, for us, anybody under the age of 50, who thinks they have something to say and something to offer when it comes to aviation safety. As you can tell from us, we have a variety of backgrounds. You don't have to be an inside-the-fence aviation professional to have a perspective, to have an opinion, to have good content to share. So if you're one of these folks who wants to produce content on social media, podcasts, audio, whatever, do it. Your voices are valuable. Aviation is an all-hands-on-deck affair, and every perspective is one that we should be listening to. If you have one, please bring it.
And with that, John, we will leave you with the last word.
And my last word has been the same for a while. It's aimed at our pilots out there, mostly general aviation. If you're going to go flying, do a good session of pre-planning. Do it twice. Once at home before you go to the airport, and then again at the airport. And if they don't agree, find out why. After you get out to your airplane, do the best pre-flight you know how to do. And if you have any doubts, find a mechanic that works on that airplane. And I know most mechanics will be glad to help you out, give you some pointers on how to make your pre-flight better than it is. And given all the traffic that we have in the air today, and we talked a little bit about it already on the show, right? When you get in the air, put that head on a swivel, because you don't want to be involved in somebody else's accident. Pay attention to what's around you so that you can avoid it. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetytotexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.
That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detectives. Until the next episode, fly safe.
Premium credits are subject to underwriting guidelines, including Avemco recognized training and memberships.